Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2019, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Now, I have been away for quite some time. I've actually been visiting in Namibia in southern Africa, and I'm really excited that the next two episodes that I'm bringing to you, I actually recorded while I was visiting there. But before I dive into the content of this episode, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because I use this community-based model. So if you are interested in supporting the show, all you've got to do is go to patreon.com/talknerdy and you can pledge your support on an episodic basis. I also read ads on the show, which you'll hear halfway through. And I also support the show through podcast merchandise. So if you're interested in showing your support visually, maybe getting a cool t-shirt or something else, all you've got to do is go to talknerdymerch.com. This week, the top supporters through Patreon include Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so, so very much. Okay, I'm really excited about this episode. I know I say that each week. I actually do mean it every week, I promise. But this one is really special. So I had the opportunity to sit down for a short time with the director of NASCO, Maxi Lewis. Now, NASCO stands for the Namibian Association of CBNRM Support Organizations. And if you don't know what a CBNRM is, it's a community-based natural resource management group. So I'm actually going to let her tell you more about what that means. So without any further ado, here she is, Maxi Lewis. Well, Maxi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
So tell the listeners, just for a little bit of background, I'm here in Namibia. I was invited to speak at the Journalism Symposium portion of the CIC Conservation Conference, which is also a lot about conservation hunting. Mm-hmm. Next week, you guys will be able to hear a very in-depth conversation that I had with a hunter who cares very deeply about conservation. But prior to that, I wanted you to meet Maxi because Maxi was kind enough to, I guess, guide us is a good way to put it, when we visited a local conservancy mm-hmm. here in Namibia. What was the name of that conservancy? Because I cannot pronounce it.
I think it was Conservancy. So it's we speak the Click language in Namibia, and so we have four clicks in their language called the Damaranama language, and so it actually just means elephant's corner. Kwadi, it's elephant, and Kwas is corner.
It's beautiful. And you yourself speak several languages, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I do speak several languages.
How many, if you had to count them?
Maybe nine.
Nine languages.
Yes.
Okay. Is this because you have a kind of innate skill, or is it because you felt the need to be able to communicate with so many different people?
I grew up in a suburb, what you guys in the US would call suburb, us we call it location.
Okay.
So I grew up in a location, and it was a multi-tribal type of a location where I lived among people speaking different languages. The Damaranama languages were not part of it. That I learned later on as I started doing conservation work. A lot of the other languages were very much Bantu languages. So that's why it was easy for me to pick up. Because with Bantu languages, there's always something that link onto the next, you know, language. Mm. So the Damaranama one, the Click one, I learned when I started working in the Northwest at this conservancy where I visited with Kara, and that is where it was very interesting because this community first, I was not from their community, mm-hmm. so I didn't speak their language, and they decided that, and I don't know whether it was a test, but they just decided, you know what, if she's really willing to work with us and have this impact that she's promising us in our community, the first thing she's going to do is to learn our language. And this is a very difficult language to learn because a lot of people find it very difficult to pronounce those clicks. Mm-hmm. So I was forced in meetings just to listen to these clicks right and left and make sure that I pronounce them correctly, making sure that I learn the language. So that's the one language which I learned outside of where I grew up. But the rest was just because I grew up in a very multicultural society.
And you were born and raised here in Namibia?
I was born. My father came from the neighboring, my mother, but that is generations back. Mm. Her father came to Namibia in the late, I think it must have been close to maybe in the 1900s or something. That's what mm-hmm. I hear. They moved from Angola into Namibia looking for some work or something. And so he moved here. That is my great-great-grandfather. So he found a job here and they started working. And this is where he met my mother then was born. But then they met my father here. And that's how I grew up. I was born in Windhoek, which is where we are now. Mm-hmm. Not very far from here, maybe 20 minutes drive in I was born in a location there, and I grew up in Windhoek, but not where you are now. I grew up in a very, it was a location, and I grew up in the apartheid system. So mm-hmm. I was growing up very far from here, where it was just a location for blacks yeah. staying there. So that's where I grew up. That is my childhood. I went there to school until I finished school. But at an age of around 14 years, I started getting involved in politics. And let me tell you, I became a student activist at a very early age. And it's not because I volunteered to become that. It was the environment, the situation that was every day people were just being killed or there was some trouble. So it was just part of the system, whether you like it or not. That's how you grew up. And I became a student activist when I was around 14 years old. So I belong to a student movement called NANSO, which is the Namibia National Student Organization. And for some reason, I don't know, maybe I was just bound to be a leader because I was selected at an age of 15 to be representing young girls. Because at the time, we had a lot of pregnancies, teenage pregnancies. It's not as if I knew anything about pregnancies at around that age. But we wanted to get that message across that you can go to school. And because at the time I was doing very well at school, people were using me as an example to go out there and influence other young women in terms of going to school. But when I was at school, the thing that really had an impact on me was the issue of human rights, that I felt, you know, as a Namibian, everybody, you know, it was your right to be what you were, you know, to speak mm-hmm. freely, to be what you wanted to be, but also to have access. And the issue of access is probably what drove me to do conservation, because I felt that we did not have access to everything.
And this was both in terms of the gender conversation, the race conversation, and even to some extent, just the poverty conversation.
Yes, yes. That's actually, it was actually an agenda that was filled with so much. Mm-hmm. And I was very young, at sometimes very, very confused, but also very militant. But I think that actually drove me to take up certain things at a very early age that yeah. no young person will actually take up.
Did your parents support it or were they scared for you?
My father was, when I was born at 3 years, my father was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So I didn't really know him because he was in a mental institute the whole time. My mother was a domestic worker. Mm. So I think she understood me. But then on the other hand, she was afraid because people were getting killed, you know, people disappeared. So she didn't want me to disappear. She didn't. And I had a little sister who was looking up to me and she was doing everything. And so she, for some reason, she hated me because she thought, why is she doing this to her little sister? If she wants her life, let her live her life. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, she could see that whatever happens in the future, she sees me as somebody who will take up some leadership courses, you know. So she was a little bit also divided, I think, as a mother. You know, on one hand, she wanted me to be safe.
Yes.
Yeah, she wanted me to be safe. On the other hand, she was also scared, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But deep down, I think she was probably also proud, or she knew that the future required. I mean, you were very much at the what we would call the bleeding edge.
Yes,
right out in the forefront of these movements.
When I was growing up, my mother was my mentor because I saw her as a very strong woman. She, not having a father around, I mean, for me, she was that person that will go out. So I actually look up to her in that. But we also differed when it came to politics.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I was like a rebel. Like, why is she not wanting me to do what I want to do? So in that way, until I was around maybe an adult, 19 years old, I really look up to her as being this strong woman that could bring up like 7 kids all by herself. Mm-hmm. And she was still going very strong. So in that way, so I did not have that father figure. I had uncles and so forth, but they were not really like there 24 hours for me. They just came in when there was cultural things like, oh, now you need to get married, you know, can we have a look for a husband for you? So not the guidance in terms of mentoring me what life will actually bring. Yeah. So that was my life in Windhoek. But then after 1990, we got independence, and I was one of the luckiest women. I was selected then to go and study in Australia, and that was because I did so well at school. And so when I left the country around that time, I felt, you know what? I really want to do something where I want to make a difference. Mm-hmm. First of all, I thought agriculture, and I thought, no, I grew up in Windhoek, it's so dry, that is not going to work. And I thought, why can I use conservation or tourism as a way of having that impact? And so while I was there, I looked at the indigenous group of people, the Aborigines, because it was up in Northern Territory. I learned so much from these people. Because remember, I was an urban child before even I left Australia. So I then was set up in a rural area. I look at these people and I thought, why, there's so much you can do with these people to make a change in their lives. So I realized, wow, I also have San communities.
Yeah.
I also have the Himba. And since my father come from the Himba, when I go back, this is exactly what I wanted to do. This is what I want to do. So I studied. So when I finished my studies, I came back home. The first thing I did, I went to a park, a national park. And this is where I saw my first elephant.
The first time in your life after you had come back from Australia?
I was around, around 20 something years old. I saw it and I was really taken back that, wow. And the reason why I went to a park, I would have probably not done it, is because when I went to Australia, they will keep asking me, you are from Africa? Where's the elephants?
And I'm ride an elephant to school?
Exactly. And I'm like, I live in a town, I've never been to a park. So that actually drove me. And so I took a trip by myself. I went there. I stayed there for a couple of days. And then I realized, wow, this is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. I can do so much. And then somebody told me while I was there, these elephants also move out of the park. And I realized, yeah, but there are people outside the park. So that's when I started now thinking, I also want to do something outside the park.
Yeah.
So there was this lady who was an economist. She was British. She was doing some work around looking at assessing the economic status of tourism in Namibia, but looking at the communal areas. So she needed a translator. And I said, and somebody was going around and said, oh, she needs somebody who speaks different languages. So I fitted that because I could speak the languages. So she took me to the Northwest. That's the area where we went there. So I went to a place where I met some other Namibians that are living there. And they were telling me around the fire quite a lot of stories of how tourists visit their places and they don't give them money, mm-hmm. or how the animals actually kill their livestock. So all these stories of human wildlife conflict and how people suffer and they have no income, it really affected me thinking, wow, I have the skills. I speak the languages. Why can I not do something about it? And I mean, I want to have a career in conservation. Maybe this is the opportunity. So that's how my whole life then started.
So it's interesting to me that it took leaving the country and going to an island with a very rich indigenous culture to then want to come back and learn more about the indigenous culture here within your country.
Yes. But that is also because I was born an urban person.
Yeah.
I think it could have been different for somebody probably in rural areas.
Who
they
grew
might
up
want
around
to become an economist living in town. Mm-hmm. I had the other way around, that I wanted to be out in the rural areas because all my life I was in a town.
And so there's a theme that you guys will hear next week when you hear my interview with Byron that we touch on briefly, but I think might be an interesting theme for you and I to really dive a little bit deeper into, which is the idea that wildlife conservation, especially in these conservancy regions, and even to some extent within these national park regions here in Namibia and many other parts of Africa, wildlife conservation is at its core a human rights issue. These things are inextricably linked to one another. Yes. So I would love to explore that with you a bit. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, when I started working in conservation, especially in rural Namibia, I felt, and that is also the African dispensations, you know, the whole colonial setup way back when Africa was colonized, is that we don't have such a good history, mm-hmm. and especially when it comes to conservation. A lot of it is that people were, you know, parks were created and people were moved. Already somebody's right was taken away by governments.
They were actually taken out of their homeland and pushed outside the park boundaries.
Or they were in a park and then pushed out. Yeah, that's what you're saying. You're saying mm-hmm. the same thing. Then they were pushed out. Mm-hmm. So that is very sad because it's already somebody's human right that is affected and impacted by that. And the bad thing is, I can give you an example. In Etosha, especially in the Northwest, when I started working with communities and I was very young, I could not understand when they said to me, we have the graves of our parents in the park. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The park is a park. It's owned by the state. And then one day they took me in and they went to show me the graves. So, and I'm a herero, which is, we have to sometimes go back and do certain rituals in the with our ancestors.
This is your tribal community.
Yeah, that is my mm-hmm. tribal community. It's not all of them that do it, but where I come from, we can always go back and do this. And some of them could not go back there because now they cannot go, they have to go through a system where they fill in a paper. And sometimes you just want, like you visit, like in an urban area or wherever, you want to go back to your grave and just sit at your grandmother's grave. That's also what they want to do. They can do that.
And they're not legally allowed to.
Yes, every time they go in, they have to get permission to go in. So that was the first years in my country. And I felt, this is their right. Mm. Why should they be? First of all, they were moved out of the park. Secondly, now they need to have permission just to go and sit at a grave. You know, that is not right. And I'm sure somewhere else in other parts of the world, this is even worse, you know. Oh. So the other one was also that I felt that they have no decision making over the resources that they are sitting on the land. Okay, so it's like in our country that was previously. Now, I mean, after independence, then things started improving.
But during these colonial periods.
Yeah, during the colonial period, this is how people were removed. This is how people's rights were actually taken away. And for me, that is a basic right. Yeah.
And to be clear, just for context, apartheid ended a little bit earlier here in Namibia than in South Africa. Namibia was part of South Africa.
Namibia was like a province. It was treated as a province of South Africa when I was growing up. For instance, for me to do my standard 10 or grade 12 exams, my exam paper came from Pretoria in South Africa. Mm-hmm. So I was like part of South Africa. It was just like any KwaZulu-Natal province or any province in South Africa.
So there was Afrikaans here, but also a large German population because Namibia was also German colonial.
Yeah, in the 1900s, it was a German colony. Then it was handed over some time back as a protectorate when the world, I think it's World War II or something ended. It was handed over to South Africa. Because I think the British at the time were, and then from there on, South Africa just took us on. They never wanted to give us back again. They didn't want to give us our independence back.
So you were under the same apartheid system as South Africa.
Yes, we were under exactly the same thing, the homeland system, the apartheid system. I think because we were treated as a province, a lot of people did not know about us. Mm-hmm. They just thought, yeah, it's a province. We are part of South Africa, but we were never part of South Africa. So as a result, the world never really got to know about Namibia. You know? Yeah. So it's just later on that people started understanding what was happening. So anything that we went through, all their laws, all their policies, we went through. Mm-hmm. So when you look at even the Nature Conservation Ordinance, it was exactly the same South African one. So what we did in 1990 as Namibians, we changed that. So we started slowly giving rights back now to the communities. But these are management rights.
Yes.
So anything on public lands is a management right. So we have customary rights. We have this program called conservancies where they have rights over wildlife. We have community forests through another act where they can do forestry. But I sometimes still feel that it's a bit of a holdback, mm-hmm. that they really, because they are living on these lands, they need to have the powers to make certain decisions on those pieces of land. But that's me being the extremist, being the activist. Okay, but I think so far things are when I compare where I came from and what they have now, I think we are doing very well as a country. I mean, the government give all the income to those conservancies. Mm-hmm. The state could have said, you know, we are taking a stake into that, but they don't. They give 100% to the communities. So those are some of the changes that we have gone through. I think the only pressure we have now, and this is more to do with wildlife, where I feel this is a human right, is because some people from outside make decisions from outside.
My country.
People from your country, people from Europe, people from anywhere else own wildlife in Namibia, I tell you. They own the elephant. They own the rhino. They don't care where it moves. They don't care what it destroys. They don't understand what an ordinary Namibian go through when every day they can't get up and go and look for food in the field freely, let their kids go to school freely, because once there's a problem, a retaliation, the whole world scream.
Yeah.
But once, and they don't think about these families.
No, so there's a family living in, let's say, in a conservancy.
Yes.
And to be clear, especially in the conservancy that we visited,
yes.
This is a place where people and wildlife coexist. There are
yes.
no fences.
There are no
boundaries.
Yeah. Yes.
And so sometimes a woman, you told a story the other day about a lion
yes.
recently.
Yes.
What happened in that situation?
You know, there's actually a lot of stories. Let me tell you one about an elephant that I can
sure.
remember very well.
Mm-hmm.
I traveled because I work in these areas. I traveled to go and do some work, and it was in Kwading Oas mm-hmm. Conservancy. This is a real story. I got there the morning because my car had my conservation sticker on it. A couple of people ran to me and they said, "Did you know that somebody was killed yesterday by an elephant?" And I was shocked. And they were very angry because mm-hmm. for them, I'm the conservationist. I'm the one who's, even though I work with them,
yeah.
I do understand their stories, but there was a lot of anger. Now, I had two ways to do it. I could have just got into my car and drove away and not listening. But on the other hand, I also know that I will have to come back and still work with these people. So I have to go and sympathize. So I went to the household and there was a lot more anger, but I went with a government official. There was even a lot more anger when they saw the government mm. official with me, which it was a mistake. I should have not gone with him. Mm. And we sat inside and people were really crying and everything. As we sat there, I just realized that the kids of the granny came and they talked to me and they said, "You know what? You are the people that are promoting this. When we kill elephants, we always hear there's a noise from people internationally that are making a lot of this noise." It's very difficult for me in that circumstance to explain and say, you know, I'm not the person. I'm also just trying to help. These people don't understand. They don't know how you live. You know, it's not time for that. These people are angry. So we sat there for like 2 hours being insulted by these people. And also just hearing the crying and thinking about what that family is going through. I think it's something in my mind that I will never forget. Eventually, the funeral took place and we went to the funeral. But at the time when the funeral took place, things have cooled down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I went back after the funeral. Normally what happens is that the family meet and then they discuss what is next. I was very surprised coming back and they said, "We will still be conservationists. We'll still belong to the conservancies. This wildlife belongs here. We'll still continue to do wildlife." And this is after you have lost somebody and you are still very angry and you still, you know, you don't even know this woman, she was a breadwinner, where your next meal is going to come from, but you are still prepared to sacrifice that. So we have these incidences quite a lot. And people losing a whole crawl of livestock. That is their bank. And I keep on explaining to urbaners, you know, if I get paid and I have my salary in my bank, the next morning is just gone and the bank cannot even explain to me what happened to my...
And nobody can help you with that.
Yes.
Yeah, nobody
My life is over. And it happens to somebody in the rural area because that is their bank.
Because an elephant tramples their livestock
exactly.
or a lion eats their cows
everything
or their goats.
Or a whole dam that... A water point that she invested her whole money get destroyed. Her cattle cannot drink the water. She needs to now depend as a handout from government to come and fix it.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't want to depend on government. She wants to be like anybody, any of us, going and having a job, you know, and on a salary. So I think when we live in urban areas, we like disassociate ourselves from life in rural areas or farm areas because we think these people are different. They think different. These people are just like us. They just live in different environments. Mm-hmm. They are just human beings like us. If they suffer, if somebody in Kwading was lost their livestock, it's like anybody in the US who just lost their job and they also have nothing. That's how these people feel. So we should put ourselves in the shoes of these people. The next time when you sit in front of a computer on social media and you just write and it influences somebody who was going to make a contribution, an impact to something, just withdraw because you just could not understand.
Nope.
Or you are refusing to understand what life is because you just love your animal.
And sometimes I feel like there is a sensibility around the world, and it could be linked to entrenched racism, tribalism, you know, sectarian views. It could be linked to a romanticization of African animals. You know, these are, Jason made a great point, and I mention it again next week in my interview with Byron, that his 2.5-year-old niece recognizes an elephant and a lion before she recognizes local wildlife, that they're so romantic in our minds, these, especially the big five, or not even, just these large African mammals, that you almost get, and sometimes absolutely get, the sensibility from people that they care more about the life of an animal than they do about the life of a human being. And I think a lot of these things come together to cause that, but it's very easy for people in the West, unfortunately, to minimize the needs and the human rights of the people living with the wildlife and say, but we must save the elephant above all else. And what happens when you work so hard to save the elephant and you ban hunting and you you ensure that the local community, if they retaliate or if they must kill an animal for meat, that they are imprisoned because this is poaching in these areas? What happens then is all these downstream effects that we never think about. Economic downturn, actual health and human safety difficulties, lack of food, and more than that, an overabundance of wildlife, which is not sustainable for the land.
Especially where we were.
Mm-hmm.
That is a semi-desert area. You cannot have an overpopulation of wildlife in those areas. And for centuries, we've been managing that land in a very sustainable manner. And unfortunately, trophy hunting has been part of that. And wildlife increased on that piece of land. It didn't go. You know, I understand that in Africa and everywhere else, where we have these mega animals that people really love all over the world, the elephants, the lions, the leopard, the cheetahs, I understand that a lot of these things are also disappearing at an alarming rate. But in the parts of the world where we come from, in Southern Africa, we have been doing so well that these things survive because of the way we manage it, the way the models that we have set up to manage them. We are also conservationists, you know? We are conservationists at heart that would like, you know, I cannot, as a child, I cannot see Africa without a lion. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to see that. I cannot see Africa without an elephant. It's not something that I would not like to, you know? I would like to have Africa with all those animals that we know Africa with. So it will be very dumb just to kill it off completely, just senseless killings. And that's not what we want to do. All we want to people to understand is that why are you trying to take away something good that is working from us and destroying all the hard work that we have put in over years, making sure that elephant, that lion, that cheetah, that leopard can continue to live. And we have a model. And I normally say, come, it's not a perfect model. Yeah, but it works. So come and see what we do and see what, you know, difference it makes, rather than just say, oh, we need to save it.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Landish. Now, the founders at Landish knew very well what it's like for a lot of us who work too much and probably don't eat well enough. And they decided to solve that problem in a really innovative way using algae, mushrooms, and actually insects. Yes, in bar and powder form. They make these really great nutrient-dense bars and protein powders with yummy and alternative and also sustainable foods like spirulina microalgae, reishi mushroom, and my absolute favorite, which is cricket powder. And they're nutrient dense. They taste really, really good. They come in a lot of different flavors like double chocolate, apple cinnamon, mint chocolate, even vanilla coconut. And there's just, I don't know, there's so much good stuff to say about them. They're not too sweet. They're not chalky like regular protein bars. And they're really, really easy on the go, especially for people like you and me who work too much and don't always stop to enjoy our meals. So guys, I highly recommend that you stock up now to make sure that you have food, healthy food, for that next time your week gets a little bit out of control. If you're not a bar or protein powder person, honestly, these might turn you into one. So go try them out. If you order right now, you'll get 30% off at landish.co. That's LANDISH.CO by using the code NERDY. Again, that's 30% off at landish.co with the offer code NERDY. I also want to thank Puppo for their support of the show. Puppo makes pet parenting easier because it takes the guesswork out of choosing the right food for your dog. Whether your dog is a big one, a little one, whether super active or kind of a couch potato like mine, Puppo is going to help make food that is unique for your dog's dietary needs, including personalized nutrition, quality ingredients, and a really smart delivery system. And we're talking, you know, nutritional specificity for your dog's age, size, even the size of their mouth. You know, a little dog needs smaller kibble for their activity level, for their sensitivities. My guy Killer has super sensitive coat in the summertime, and he's kind of got a bit of a sensitive stomach. Yes. Okay. All right. He's a little bit wimpy, but I love him. And Puppo really helps your dog maintain a healthy weight, which is super, super important. What I can tell you, hands down, is that Killer loves the food. I've actually had to slow down how he eats it because he likes it so much more than his regular kibble. And probably the best part, I know it's silly, but I just love it, is that you get a personalized bag with just the right amount of food for a very specific time frame. And it's got a picture of your little guy on the front, or girl, your little guy or girl. So go to puppo.com/nerdy and you're going to get 14 days of personalized dog food. It'll be delivered for only $9, which is a great deal. Remember, that's puppo.com, puppo.com/nerdy for 14 days of personalized food for only $9. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
You know, the other one that I also think it's a human rights issue that you ask is the issue of the voice. Gara, you visited the Squatting Owls Conservancy. You hear the voices of those communities. You saw in what areas they don't have the Wi-Fis. They don't have the television screens to watch what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. They depend on people like us going there and telling them what is happening. So it's the Western world that has the voice because they have access to resources and social media that are making decisions on behalf of the people that have no voice.
Yeah.
So I would love to have them have social media so that they can respond to you the way I'm responding, but they don't. Yeah. And so somebody else is making those decisions on their behalf. And those ones that have the resources, which I think it's another way of colonialism for me.
Absolutely.
So, and I think it's very good for anybody in this 19th century that you want to suppress people just because it's all about you. Mm-hmm. I'm a vegan. It's all about me.
Yeah.
I love animals. It's all about me. You know, and I don't think that's fair on anybody else. You know, I'm not a hunter. I don't hunt. But just because I don't hunt does not mean I should hate handing, because there are other people that make a livelihood out of that. Mm-hmm. And so as long as they do it sustainably, I'm
and
fine
legally.
With that. Yeah, and legally, yeah. I'm fine with that. So I think we should also be, you know, the thing is, when it's right for me to think the way I'm thinking and I have a populist view around some of this issue, mm-hmm. then it's fine. But, you know, we have to be very careful that we don't destroy. And, you know, we are thankful. We are really thankful. I also think that if it was not for some of people in Europe or America or anywhere else, that a lot of things that we do will not be possible.
Mm.
But it is possible now. But don't enforce, don't push down your decisions on people. Then this is where we have a difference than in opinion.
Absolutely. And this is why it was so important to me to be able to steal some of your time today. I know you're so busy here at the conference and you know, coming to the city, going back to the Conservancy, all of the work that you do. Because even though, you know, in many ways you are a layer between the local people and the West, you can maybe not ever fully speak for them, but you can at least represent their views and their interests in a way that I think is just so fundamentally important for the people listening to this podcast right now to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so important for me that I have a chance to be able to hear that from your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Maxie, I know that you have to get back for some meetings, but before we go, mm-hmm. I was hoping that you would be willing to answer at the end of my podcast, no matter who my guest is, I always ask them the same two questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just really excited to hear your answer, your perspective on these two questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they are that when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you right now, so it could be the future of your family, your work, the future of your community, the
mm-hmm.
globe.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night that you are maybe pessimistic, not very excited about, a little worried about,
mm-hmm.
very worried about? And on the flip side of that, what is the thing that you are most optimistic and hopeful for?
Okay. What keeps me up all night, and this is real, is, but that was all my life long, is I would like, I have two. One is for myself as a family, it's more love. Apart from, you know, when I got involved in conservation, there's one thing that I realized later on. You always realize your hobbies later on in life. I love children.
Yes.
And for me, I think working in rural areas, the one thing I would never love to see is a child go hungry,
mm-hmm.
a child not receiving love. So I have this thing for children that I don't know, maybe because when I became a mother, that's when this thing then started growing in me. But children, and I'm very worried about the children in the world, not just in Africa or in my country. It's one thing that I'm very worried about.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me sleepless nights. Because even if I came from very uneducated parents, I had love. You know, that love is something that I think gave me all the... That it makes me what I am today, because I can give love to other people and make a difference in other people's lives. So I think if you have love, you will do, the other things are natural. They will come back to, will come back. That's one thing. I think the other one is for me, what is this issue of, because I work with communities and I'm very much somebody who believes in people's voices, is that I feel, but very diplomatically sometimes, these voices are becoming less and less in the world.
Yeah.
And I see this also happening in my country, that we find ways diplomatically to still say, you have a voice, but I will still cut you short to make your voice less heard. And that is something that worries me quite a lot. I am optimistic about the future. I think it's a good world. There's good people. You know what? Just to have you journalists coming and talk to those guys yesterday, you know that it could have cost me a lot of money to be flown somewhere
mm-hmm.
and maybe just to talk to one journalist. But when I was on that plane, I thought, wow, this has always been my dream to take journalists to get the voice of those communities by themselves. And you did that. And you could see they were really like very... happy to talk, yeah. very happy to share. And I think it's something which I think that linkage, that more linkage in the world between where we never had access to hear from the real people, to hear from them. Mm-hmm. And I think it will get better, to be honest. Yeah. I think there is a better world, technology and is making it better. I mean, I just realized where I was 20 years ago and what I see happening give me a lot of hope that things will get better. Maybe not in my generation. Sometimes we try to get everything done in one generation.
Yeah.
But I'm really optimistic that it is going to, there will be change and things will get better. And it's people like you that get this message across that will make it better.
Maxie, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. It's been illuminating and also incredibly humbling. So I want to thank you for joining me and taking the time today.
No, thank you, Kara. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.